The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Management of chronic coronary syndromes is presented by Dr. Robert Chilton.
Look at this slide. All these articles I put on the web that you guys have, they're full articles. They're fair game. And all of these are these different kinds of criteria for different things that are brand new. So if you want, what I would suggest you do with these articles is I would look at just the columns that have them in class one and look at class three. That's all you need to know. The ones in the middle are not going to be asked. We will only ask you class one indications in class three. The other ones for appropriateness criteria, we would ask you questions that are the ones that are A, acceptable, or everybody agrees on, or we would ask the ones that are unacceptable. Look at those and look at your patient types. It won't take that long. You can blow through these articles pretty quickly. To give you an idea, I blew through all these articles on the plane coming down here in about 3 hours. Just look at those criteria. I looked through it. It will be more than you'll need for the board exams. But it's the most current stuff that we have. But you can see they're not 2017 for most of them. Most of them are in 2015, 2012. We cannot ask you questions that are not guideline-based. Okay? Common sense stuff I've already gone over. But for the guidelines, these are where it comes from. Now, this next section, I'm starting right on time, so we should be right up to par in a second, is chronic stable angina basically is the topic. Now, what I did for this one, since we need to focus, really focus tight for the boards to get you the general principles of what we're trying to get you to do, the environment is really important. The one up there on the first slide that says global risk reduction, it wins every time. It beats every drug I have. There is nothing going to beat weight loss and exercise. You can try, but you will fail. Because between the time you're skinny and you're fat, there's the valley of death. Nobody seems to ever get to the other side. Okay? Now, the other one on the board exams, when I took them, was this one right here. You guys don't think much of that one, but if you start looking at the numbers, influenza vaccination in older people wins because they die from it. Don't forget that. It looks like a little dinky point, but it's a big one. And they usually ask stuff like that. The other ones on the vascular tissue, I'll cover these when I go through it, each one of those. And I'll also tell you about the lipid guidelines. They are in total flux. Basic bottom line, lower is better. Now, how low do you go for the board exams? I think we'll be using 70 for the board. You could argue we might use 50 from the IMPROVE-IT trial, but hopefully they won't get you caught between those two ranges. If you have ischemic heart disease or you have diabetes, you need to be in the 50 to 70 range for LDL. That's it. Triglycerides, don't treat them unless they're over probably 250 to 500. Do we have evidence for that? I think we do. The board doesn't think so. So don't treat triglycerides in general. If the triglycerides are high, though, there are going to be a problem. And the rest of it, I'll go through and talk about as I go. But those are some just opening guidelines. Picking mom and dad. This is the endothelium. This is your life. When the lights go out, you go out. And that basically, the lights are nitric oxide. And it has continually been the actual basic area that we deal from translational biology. And I think you have to be aware of that. Every drug you give hits here. Every disease pattern hits here. And everything triggers from here and runs the entire heart vessels throughout your entire body. So whatever you can make this baby healthy, you will find wins every time. Now, if you take a 60-year-old person, he presents with increased shortness of breath and fatigue, and again, there's his blood pressure and stuff. Here is what you might see on an angiogram. Nice question would be, what do you want to do with this? I've got a proximal LAD lesion up here. They're not going to give you angiograms, but they'll give you the case. I've got this coronary blocked, and the right one's already gone. This is three-vessel heart disease. The reason the right one's gone is I can see it down here. Why would you need to know that? It's because you guys got lots of patients that got three vessel disease that are not walking very fast because they don't get chest pain and they just sit around. You're treating this guy. So does he need a bypass? If he has proximal LAD disease or a left main, two vessel or a guy that has low ejection fraction, those are all heading towards bypass. Would you stent those? Well, just for practical purposes, you would take a lot of stent here. You'd have to stent a whole lot of stuff. And stents only are palliative. Stents don't stop heart attacks. I give you a heart attack. Stents don't prevent you from having a heart attack down the road either. They're only for getting rid of chest pain. I know, everybody saw them. Stent is not do much. It just simply does it. If you want to stay alive, you got to do microvascular. Surgery will make you live a little bit longer, but not much. You lose about 5% per year on your grafts. Your left ventral mammary artery is open at 95% or so at 10 years. That's my best graft. So whatever you do surgically, you got to give me a Lima. If you don't put a Lima in somebody, he ain't going to live very long. He's going to be the same as giving him stents. So a solemn word of advice is that I stent all day long, and I can tell you, stents, they'll be back. And they'll be back, and the vessel that I fixed with the stent, that's not the one I have to fix again. It's the other one that got worse. So be prepared to answer questions like that. But the treatment, global risk reduction is a treatment for everybody. So let's be a little bit more problematic here. What is his yearly mortality if he's medically treated? So you say, well, this guy's got three vessel disease. Where would you put this guy? He's going to be an 8% mortality every single year. So if you count off 10 people in a row, one of you ain't going to be around. Does that make it practical? That's three-vessel heart disease. Now, everybody in the room has cardiovascular disease, so you don't have to feel uncomfortable. We all share the same disease. All of you have blocks in your coronaries. How do we know this? Because we have to pay $1 million for a heart transplant. And we have to IVUS every person, every 16-year-old, every 14-year-old has a motorcycle wreck. They all have heart disease. So all of you have it. It's just whether or not it's bad enough to give you symptoms. If it gives you symptoms, we can put a stent in you. You want to live longer? Lose weight and exercise and take your drugs that we know decrease your cardiovascular risks. It won't be the stent. But there's an example of how fast atherosclerosis will get you. It goes straight on up. You can do calcium scores if you want. Calcium score is a number. Or you can do a risk calculation score that tells you if you're going to have a heart attack. I kind of like the risk score myself, but I use calcium scores occasionally. Now, here's a practical one. If your patient gets heart failure or it's your family member, how many more years are they going to live? If they have heart failure, it's only 4. It's the worst. And it hasn't changed. This is actually Framingham data 40 years out. So heart failure is one that you don't want to get to. When the ejection fraction starts to fall, you get in trouble. Well, you may say, well, Bob, you know, the ejection fraction is probably only 55%. He has diastolic dysfunction, but he gets heart failure. If you get severe diastolic dysfunction, you're going to have a similar number. So since diabetes now is 60-70% of people have diastolic dysfunction, this is starting to carry a lot more weight. It used to be just dead ventricles from infarcts. It's not now. It's shifted over to people that have diastolic dysfunction with preserved ejection fractions. So be aware of this. This heart failure thing isn't really a good one for you. Here's a Johns Hopkins Medical School study. Now, you probably saw this when you were coming over. This is bothersome. All of you are in medical school. I'm going to take your blood the day you walk in, and then I'm going to look 42 years later by what your lipid level was, total cholesterol, if you're alive or dead. Y'all did. I mean, that's what happened in medical school. So here we go. Get ready for this one. Here's your curve. You get into practice. I guess most of you would have started in medical school 0. You go through your residency. You get through your subspecialty training. And now you're in practice. Now you're starting to divide up. And you notice that some of you are having heart attacks. And you notice the number on the cholesterol is not that high at the top. We used to think 300 was okay. But you can see we've actually, by losing a biomarker, I can show you who is not going to do well long term. And it splits even more as you get further out. So for most of us, as you get more senior, you can see this division is really impressive. So it is a good biomarker. It does predict. So lower is better, and it hasn't changed. If you give a statin, I've got data for that. If you add ezetimibe to it, I got data for that. And this week, as Marty and many of us ACC, we got the Fourier trial. I got a PCSK9 that'll drive you down to 10 to 30, and it's even better. Now, whether you'll take that's another thing, but it's interesting. Lower's better all the way across, so we need to pay attention to this risk factor. As far as guidelines go, here's again the chronic angina uptake. This has not changed. Why would you use 27 when this is 2017? Is because the way we do the guidelines, we don't go back to the original writing paper. We just simply add additions to it. But the real meat is in this paper. So you're going to have to go back to this huge document if you want to see the real data to support everything that we say. At the same time, we'll have more updates, and I'll update this as we go through the talk. But by and large, class one aspirin hasn't changed. Most of us will give aspirin to people that have chronic stable angina. Mechanism behind that in principles is that you're trying to decrease the actual formation of platelets that would give you a block and give you a heart attack. When you rupture a plaque on a vessel wall, it will start to clot. The first thing there is platelets. You're going to block COX-1. It has two blocks. It blocks cyclooxygenase 1, and it turns around and blocks thromboxane A2, and has a special lipoxene block at which actually decreases inflammation. So this one drug does a lot of stuff. You just need low doses, all you need. The clinical case would be, I would give you a patient with arthritis that has chest pain, and a question I might ask you, she wants to take her non-steroidal. Does she take it first before the aspirin or after the aspirin? If you take it first, you block the aspirin effect at the binding pocket, so it doesn't have any effect. So always take aspirin first if they ask you that on the test. Beta blocker hasn't changed. Easiest way for you to remember this is, if your car is having trouble, don't race it up. Let it idle at a slower RPM. This is a beta blocker. At the same time, this is a powerful antiarrhythmic. I think this is my best antiarrhythmic. It's in amiodarone. It's in most all of our trials when we have problems with controlling arrhythmias. Beta blocker is great for slowing the heart rate, and it does decrease the actual damage on a lot of heart attacks. So this is an important drug. Beta blocker, use it. If you have heart failure, the drug is carvedilol. Don't use Inderol. Inderol kills because it has an effect on beta 2 we don't want, and it is not an antioxidant type drug that you see with carvedilol. So beta blocker definitely is a player. ACE inhibitor, another big player. This one affects the tissue level, and this stops the remodeling of the heart. If a patient has diabetes, he needs to take an ACE inhibitor to protect his kidneys. The problem with a lot of these things, the guidelines are so verbose, so you get lost in the picture. But the big picture is aspirin's important to you, beta blockers are important, ACE inhibitors are important, so you keep it straight. LDL target, less than 70, I think that's my best guess number. That's going to change. The new ACE guidelines from the Endocrine Society just dropped it to 50. So we will see. That was last 2 weeks ago. So I'm sure people will argue some more. Sublingual nitro is still probably for immediate relief the best choice. Be careful with that with Viagra because that can certainly drop people's filling pressures too much and you run into trouble. Calcium antagonist. I think if the beta blocker is not working well, then certainly you can add this. Is a beta blocker is not as good as a calcium antagonist? I don't think so. I think the beta blocker still holds number one. VFib is one that I can actually change in animal models with a beta blocker. I can't do that with a calcium blocker. But if you need it, add on the calcium blocker, and I think you'll find it helps to control angina even more. As far as the actual use of 2A drugs, here's clopidogrel. Now, this has stepped up a little bit more. I think most of us, if you have a patient come in with a non-STEMI ACS, whether or not he goes to the cath lab or not, for the first year, he has to stay on Plavix. That's the rules. Why is that the case? We've done trials, and the guys that even did not go to intervention did better on Plavix. After a year, you can argue up to 24 months more from another trial. Bottom line is, don't go over 2 to 3 years. It's difficult to justify. Maybe in time. We're struggling. Many companies have tried it. Plavix is still number one. Clopidogrel seems to be the main player. And then again, you can see all the other things that down listed in this class two. The lifestyle is important. Weight loss. Pick one thing. Weight loss will win. It'll beat you every single time. It's really important. Here's the ones in yellow I don't think you should do. Diaperamidol is not, and neither is chelation therapy. Neither one of those are on the would be appropriate choices for this. Ranolazine keeps coming back for different reasons. Mechanism is totally unknown. We don't really know how it works, but the principle of this slide is what I want to show you. If you want to decrease the workload of the heart, that's called myocardial oxygen consumption. The most important one risk factor is heart rate. This is from Brunwald studies years ago. The next most important one is wall stress. That is from the actual blood pressure. If you want to change the filling pressure to the heart where a person is not a short of breath, the way you do that and drop the filling pressure is by decreasing the venous return to the heart. Diuretics and beta blockers are the best one for heart failure for doing that. That will do the best to take the workload off the heart. If you ask me which one does nitro do the best to get rid of angina, dilate the coronaries or make the heart smaller? It's make the heart smaller. That was done by Al Parisi. And what it showed was, if you want to actually get the effect of nitro, make the heart smaller, because the law of Laplace, by changing the radius of curvature, is more powerful than dilating the coronary artery. So heart rate is a big deal. Take the workload off of the heart next and drop the preload. Contractility, I can't change. If you've infarcted it, it's probably dead muscle. Now, as far as this drug, you can use this drug. It has got higher indications all the time. I seem like people I cannot do stents on anymore, and the surgeons won't operate them. I use a lot of this, but the mechanism truly is not real known. We thought it was a late channel, but we're not sure that was done in animals, but clearly it one that works. It initially started, believe it or not, as an endocrine drug, changing the free fatty uptake in the cell. That's where it came from. This you need to know. This is the Interheart trial. The Interheart trial and the Interstroke trial are basically the same. Bottom line, I can show you 90% of the things that cause the first heart attack. And if you look, lipids and smoking are at the top of the list. And then you see abdominal obesity, then you see hypertension, then you see diabetes. Notice this group of people that are all related to obesity, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome. They will give you cases because most of your patients have metabolic syndrome. For every metabolic syndrome risk factor I add to you, you will die sooner. And it hasn't changed. And the more difficult it is for Marty to do ablations, because the bigger you get, the harder it is for us to work on. So by and large, for yourself, do these things. This is important. Cut these, improve your stress levels. Those do count. Activity important. Alcohol, reasonable amounts. Red wine, how much should you drink? Now, if you ask my house staff, they think a bottle is a reasonable amount for a day. Okay, that's not the case. It's only a glass. If you get over that, you weaken brain function cells, actually, and you can bleed in your head. So you pay a price. Your heart may be better, but you'll have a stroke in the process if you drink a lot. Fruits and vegetables are important. You get salicylates from these. These are the risk factors that we can get. I can tell you by looking at these right here, 90% of the first heart attack. And strokes, the same thing when he was doing those trials. They haven't changed. Those are all the same ones. I'm changing the risk factors because I have better ones now. If you want death, there's only three. Give me your troponin, give me your BNP, and look in my eye. You paid for this. We published it about 3 months ago. It's the ARC trial. 10-year follow-up, that's the best death predictors. BNP, stretch your ventricle. Take a look in my eye and see how much vascular disease, that's my endothelium throughout my entire, and measure my troponin. Am I infarcting my heart? Those usually work. That's what's coming. You'll get more biomarkers. The more plaque ruptures that you have, and you can see from autopsy all these different plaque ruptures, notice you're getting more and more blockade of the heart. So here's the moral of the story. A guy who comes in, don't expect to see a lot of tight blocks. He has chronic angina. The guy that comes in real quick with ACS, he probably just ruptured a plaque and he only has one rupture and he split it. And when he did, he clotted everything. So what is the most powerful way to clot your artery? First up is necrotic factor inside the actual cap. So if I cut down in here and I get to the necrotic core where the fat and lipids are, it will clot like crazy, activates platelets. The next one is collagen and tissue factor right on the cap itself. Those we tear up when we do interventions, they will clot too. So if you're going to be primary care doc, you have to keep in your head, aspirin's not a bad choice for those. Plavix is not a bad choice for those. They're pretty good. Now, since all of you in here look like long-distance runners, every day you guys fracture plaques, but you heal your plaques. There's plaque heal all over the place, and you can see it up on that slide. So a guy with chronic angina is going to have a lot of plaque ruptures, but those don't really infarct you most of the time. They just give you a lot of uncomfortable feeling. We can fix those, and we can make you feel better, but I will not make you live longer, and you watch. When you look at your patient that the cardiology stent guy puts in that stent, look and see if the troponin went up. They all go up. That's infarct. It still counts. Every little goes up, and we're getting ready to change troponins. You guys measure high sensitivity of troponin. We have now an ultra-high sensitive that actually breaks it before it gets to 0.01, and it carries death rate. That's coming, so watch for that one. Here's the next area we'll cover in the interest of time, and the timing number down here is definitely not the correct time. That's too much time. So what time do I need to finish? 8? Oh, we're perfect. Okay, we're doing great. Okay, did most of you pick your mom and dad? Okay. So why do you always ask if mom and dad's alive? Look at this slide. This slide is old. It takes a long time to get some. This is a Bluska heart study. This is done in the United States. And if you look, this is mom that has heart disease, and this is not. Now, pick any one you want. You want diabetes, or do you want heart attacks, or do you want high blood pressure? Then you can pick them up by race. It looks like to me, every time mom and dad had a risk factor, you got it. So ask the history. If the guy's skinny and looks at you, he's got chest pain, but his mom and dad died when they're 45 of heart attacks, I'd listen to this guy. He probably's got some coronary disease because that carries genetic weight that we can't calculate yet. So family history, really important, and you need to watch for it. This slide, important. On this slide is actually the actual parameters that we looked at blood pressure. Let me start with this picture over here. This picture is telling you that lower is better for your blood pressure. This has been redone in the last year. Shows the same thing. The fancy blood pressure number now is 115. All the way down to 115 is worthwhile. If you look at the SPRINT trial that we've done, you paid for this. It cost you probably $1 million. It shows us that the lower is better on the blood pressure, down to about 115 to 120. I think the target is going to be about 130 for most of you. Now, the JNC, the high blood pressure guidelines, I don't agree with. Actually, there's a really nice paper in Circulation published a few months ago, but I think for the board exams, probably 140 is what they're still using. But quite honestly, 130 is what you should be in under that. And now you see down below it says diabetes and chronic renal disease. That's in the guidelines for sure. But for most folks, I'd like you to see under 130. Unless you got to take 10 different drugs, and we'll talk about those drugs. But for every one of these march, wherever you want to fight on this curve, lower is better, and it has not changed. The other thing that's in the actual tissue that you need to be aware of is people that have ejection fractions are low. Those guys need to be on ACE inhibitors, number one. Now, is an ARB equivalent to an ACE? I take an ACE first. That's what the board's like. The reason we always pick that, if you'll look, that always says ACE inhibitor, but if you can't take that, take an ARB. Why would that be the case? The case at a basic science level is it relates to bradykinin. I don't have the same nitric oxide punch that I have with an ACE inhibitor. Plus, I don't upregulate a compound called angiotensin 1-7. And that is one that makes you vasodilate and puts more blood in your microcirculation. So take the ACE first if you have it on the board exam. The second one, you can take the ARB. Pick it when you want, but do not pick pre-renin inhibitors like Alisteron. That's not a good choice. There's a number of basic recipes that didn't work, but for a low ejection fraction, the ACE inhibitor still holds. Does this help the kidneys? It does decrease microalbuminuria, and it does decrease long-term, 10 years from now, your kidney falling apart. So for a diabetes patient, the ACE inhibitor is protective for that kidney. It's only been supplanted recently, but will not be on your board exam by empagliflozin, an SGLT2 inhibitor, now is going to rival that and may even beat it. Down here is aldosterone. If you have a patient that you cannot control their blood pressure, it's not considered controlled till you block the mineralocorticoid receptor. The reason for that is that controls an axis that goes to the brain. So when you send a case to a hypertensive expert and it's not controlled, that's because you probably didn't add aldosterone blocker. How powerful is that? It completely crashed the CORAL trial. I was doing renal artery ablations to shut down neurosympathetic drive to the brain for high blood pressure. And then George Backris, in his beautiful direction, said, doesn't count to be resistant until you give an spironolactone. That destroyed the trial. There was no more hypertensive that resistant patients. So does it work? It works really good. So you get a tough patient, block this. This is salt driven. It goes off an axis called a sodium renin-angiotensin wall-bane axis, and that axis goes to your brain and actually controls the actual secretion from the postsynaptic nerve terminal of noradrenaline. So watch for this one. It's important. Now, what else do you use these blockers for? There are two trials that actually work. If you have a person that actually has had heart failure, these drugs work to decrease if you've already given them an ACE inhibitor, if they have heart failure, add this drug to it and you will actually show a benefit. That's on the board exams. The RALS trial is one, and this is the EFESIS trial. I don't have room to put them both up here, but both of those are really important ones to know. So ACE inhibitors first, and then you add the aldosterone blocker to it, which I think most of you do already for heart failure folks. This is the actual law of Laplace. I put it in your handout as a separate page. Look at this. This is cardiology. This runs everything. This runs the microcirculation. But the most important one's this one. This one's next. Volume thickness is next. That's left ventricular hypertrophy. Do you know how many people have diabetes, have LVH? 80%+. You wonder why these guys don't do well? They got stiff ventricles. So they're going to have inability to relax, which leads them into heart failure. The infarction is down there at contractility. We kind of take that, now we all have seen that for a number of years. We're looking at these new areas now, but this is the bottom line of cardiology. Now let me close out on this last part. This is metabolics. There's a lot going on here. There's a huge amount of material. What's happened is that we found out that the best marker for death for men is HDL. It's the efflux capacity. It has now beaten the Framingham risk score. So everybody's trying to find drugs that will reduce the cholesterol out of the actual macrophages in your blood vessel wall or foam cells. And there's only a few that have any potential to do that. But I think you need to be aware, the HDL is very important to you. The HDL is block for all kinds of different inflammatory markers. It has the ability to get rid of this cholesterol that weakens your wall. But for the guidelines, the number that you have to know is LDL 70. Another really important guideline number that you need to be aware of, you need to jot this one down. Years ago, Melissa Austin and Ron Krauss did a study called the Boston Heart Study. They did the studies at Berkeley. You want to know what will give you small, dense particles that will triple your heart attack rate? The way you calculate it without doing real sophisticated lipids, look at the HDL. If it's under 40 and the triglycerides over 140, everybody's got the actual small, dense particle. So that patient has to be treated. Let me give you a nice case scenario for a test. Patient's 37 years old, has type 2 diabetes, has a HDL of 34, and has a triglyceride of 300. This guy's got small, dense particles, but his LDL is only 65. You'd have missed it. So look at that HDL and look at that triglyceride. That will tell you. Now, outside of diabetes, women have heart attacks more common, have more ischemic heart disease if they have high LDL or ApoBs. Men, on the other hand, are going to be tracked by HDL in the cath lab. So HDL is a better predictor for men if that comes out in any form, shape in the test. But those are probably the main messages you need to know. Don't do anything with CRP. It's not important for the test, although it's important to me and other people doing inflammation. It's not for the exam. And I think everything else on that slide I've pretty much covered that you have to know. The small dense kills. It is really bad stuff. Now, this is an important one. Most of you don't like hematology. I didn't either, but I had to learn it. Aspirin blocks the actual receptor site on the platelet about 10%. The receptor you're trying to target is you're trying to knock off the glycoprotein 2B3A receptor. The reason you want to shut that down is because that connects fibrinogen to the other platelet, and it just keeps connecting them. And once you connect a whole lot, then fibrin comes in, you clot everything off. So your target is to block that. Now, you could take a lot of fish and 3-omega, and you can block platelets too, about 10% probably. You can use platelet or platelet type products, and you can get with Plavix up to about 35%. Or you can do some of my newer ones out there that are ticagrelor, that's a transduction blocker, not an ADP specific blocker. Or you can use one of the other drugs and do the same thing. I don't care which one you pick, stay with the guidelines. Aspirin's usually up front first. The second one up is Plavix. If you have to dump a drug because you got too many anticoagulants on a patient that has AFib, dump the aspirin, keep the Plavix. That's the newest one. Okay? So if somebody gives you a sidewinder question and you find yourself caught between getting rid of one of the two, get rid of aspirin. mechanism? Is it what you're doing internally is you're having a block on cyclic AMP inside the cell, and it's the most powerful of the two blockers. So I would pick the Plavix. We have blocks for everything on this wall, all the way around this entire platelet. Everything reactivates itself. The ones that tend to turn it on the most, as you can see up there, you got collagen, where I tear the artery, epinephrine, because you're scared to death, and everything leads into the center, and you're actually going after that 2B3A receptor, is what you're actually connecting up to, and that's showing platelet activation right down here. That's kind of an overview. It's kind of hard for you to assimilate that real quickly, but hopefully that will help you pick the right choice if it comes up. Oh, thromboxin A2, what does that do? Well, let me make it practical so you don't forget it for the boards. How many of you like steak? Everybody likes it. That's good. It's good for my business. Because steak activates the arachidonic acid cycle that upregulates thromboxin A2, that vasospasms your artery and actually activates platelets. Now, if you like fish, that's not catfish or fried. If it's whole water fish and you grill it, it goes through the actual antioxidant side and actually blocks it. It's not an arachidonic pathway. So you have two choices. It all makes sense when you look at it from basic science, but when you're trying to memorize it, it doesn't make as much sense. But sometimes those little things will help you remember when you're sitting there stressed out for the boards. Any hemoglobin A1C is not good that's high. Obviously, it's microvascular, and this connects it to systolic blood pressure. And again, this comes from a number of different studies. I don't think, if someone asked me, does lowering your glucose make any difference to macrovascular events? But it sure does for the kidney and the eye. So you have to control that blood sugar and stuff. But other than that, I don't think you would put those two together. This one shows you cholesterol, blood pressure together. You can see that you're the highest purple bar, and you will do the worst. And that's not a small study. That comes out from nearly 300,000 people. And again, that's one you need to pay attention to. Does the CRP or inflammatory markers, whichever one you want to pick, we have lots now, does that aggravate this? It certainly does. As a matter of fact, we don't think you damage the endothelium until you inflame it. How do you inflame it? Give me a risk factor and make it mad. Give me lipids and irritate it, and it will raise your inflammatory markers, and then you will end up having more atherosclerosis. This is the curves for primary, secondary, and acute coronary syndrome. You can see that primary takes a lot more patients in the study to get down to lower levels, but it's better. You can see that the actual curve of the line, the angle, is higher on the ones that have more cardiovascular events. Acute coronary syndrome is kind of weird. Now, why would that be weird? It's because we have a new problem. We have people that get plaque erosion now, not just plaque rupture. So we have two different diseases here, potentially. And so lipids may not take care of one of them. It's kind of interesting when you look at it. But it's times are evolving, and we don't know the answer. Now, I would suspect most of the guys in here take statins. I guess that means that we're all protected. Be the furthest from the truth. At the very most, you're probably only, again, probably 6 months to a year longer in some of the studies with your life. And the other thing is, if you take all these trials that are shown here, you only are still missing 73%. Those are events that were not avoided. It's not perfect. The absolute risk reduction with a statin in my best study, which is 4S, highest risk, is only 4%. That means a car tire goes 100 miles and the other car tire goes 104 miles. Not much. That's my best drug for right now. How far does the PCSK9 go? I might could get it to go maybe 4 miles more. I don't know, 104, 105 on top of a statin. It's not just a lot additive, but it is statistically significant. But the absolute risk reduction is not as impressive as most of us hope for. So we're not there. We got lots of room to work. And there again is the HDL centering in the middle. You will not have to know these pathways, but this kind of just brings it full circle to see how things work. Now, this is coming to the end of my talk, and I think I'll probably put you back on time pretty well. This is optical coherence tomography. This is a normal looking angiogram. This could be, no, I don't think anybody in here is this good, but be a kid, let's say. But this actually comes from a 38-year-old guy who looked really pretty good. But let me show you what the problem is. Everything that you see at the green arrow is soft lipid core. and there's no obstruction in the artery. This is atherosclerosis. You just can't see it. Now, the PD study in children, you paid for this. And what we found was, if you look at autopsies of the right coronary artery, there is a direct significant increase in the amount of this disease in the arteries as the BMI goes up. So with increasing BMI, you will have more atherosclerosis throughout any of your body. Coming out next month is a paper that looks at the actual cross-section of human arteries, and it measures the amount of fat next to the artery, and the more fat you have next to your artery wall, the more of this disease you got in the actual wall itself. It all fits together, so stay as skinny as you can. Who is the guy on the cath table after 75? He won't be fat, as a general rule. They're all dead. The lady is usually on the table, and she's 90, and she's a little skinny lady who drinks tea and tells you funny jokes as she goes to Switzerland for her vacation. Now, here's another one. This is new, and this is another problem that we face. Most of you are familiar with this thrombin developing on top of the cap. We tear the artery, and you tear it, and it clots up. So that's why you're given aspirin, the Plavix, and all these other drugs you want to go after. I will put a stent in this, stent it down. It looks great. The problem is that sometimes I don't have a ruptured cap, like you see over here, and I don't see that plaque cap. So what has happened? What's happened is you've killed the endothelial surface. On my first slide, I showed you hand holding the endothelium. You've taken those cells and you've killed them. Mechanism's not entirely clear. At one time, Dr. Vermani thought that it was related to women under 40 having heart attacks. They had endothelial cell erosion. Now, this has been around long enough to ask you a good question on it. So do you stent that person, or do you do an intervention? That won't be up to you. That'll be up to the interventional guy. But if you don't, and you go down there and I open the artery with a balloon, but don't stent it, and I IVUS it, and I don't find any plaque obstruction or rupture there, he does not get a stent. So what happened? Those patients usually have an LDL that's normal looking, but it has an HDL under 40 and a triglyceride over 140, the small dense particle. The small dense particle called LDL5 actually is electronegative, and it has killed this endothelial surface here and eroded it. And what you see there is a clotting problem generated from endothelial cell erosion because your body recognizes those endothelial cells, so it's now activating the actual platelets to come down there and clot that. Now, under normal circumstances, if you're exercising and you rupture a plaque, it clears. But this is an example of things that are not so clear. This is a real case of a patient that we had that actually had a plaque rupture, a standard one, and it blows out over here on the side, right there. Blew his coronary out on that side. That's what it looks like when the interventional guys are stenting it. That's what we would see. That's the most common. But this other one is gaining ground because we're having more diabetes patients around. This is the famous COURAGE trial. I don't know whether it's good or bad. I did the most stents in this trial, but I can tell you that we found not any difference between medical treatment and chronic stable angina. You have a guy with chronic stable angina, and I have him lose weight as I show up here, and I show you the LDL here. The patient on this screen actually was this guy right here. And this patient, Bob O'Rourke and I, put on the front cover of Circulation, because nobody believed that if you do medical treatment at the best, I can actually improve microcirculation. And look at this one a year later. It filled in his entire heart. And he had no stent, nothing. He just took medicine. I did global risk reduction. He walked up 6 flights of stairs to come to his last visit before he couldn't even get in the hospital. It works. Microcirculation works. Changing metabolics work. I have to say, there's a lot of patients that don't do this, but it can be done in some people. Interesting enough, this is his angiogram. When we sent him to the core lab, the tight block in the LAD was still tight. The place that improved was all the microcirculation and endothelial function. So microcirculation, really important to you. This is the one we're doing now called ischemia in the last few minutes, and now we're targeting a much more severe group of people. We're having extremely difficult enrolling in this because most of you do not want to give us a patient that has 2 zones of ischemia with chest pain, and I can't blame you. I don't like them either because some of these guys are flat going to die because this is high risk, but that's the new target. Is this the end and we can't go past this and need to do surgery, or can you just give them medicine? I don't know. And we'll see. This one is the absolute risk reduction calculated. I went through this a minute ago for you. These are my best drugs. Here's the control population. This is absolute risk reduction. And here's weight loss and proper exercise. It's going to beat you every single time. So you need to be sure that you try to stay in shape as best you can. This is down to 53 from the Improve It trial. It didn't seem like a lot, but it was significant. So it's telling us it lowers better, and now the one I have to add, which means I'll have to extend the slide that way, is I need to put it 10 to 30. I have a patient at 10. Does it affect the brain function? Many of you said, oh, it gets Alzheimer's. Didn't show that. That's not published yet, or maybe it is in the New England Journal now, this week, but it showed basically the psychological profiles are normal. But be cautious. It's only 1 year. I don't know long term. This is the take-home messages, and then I'll show you the next to last slide, I think. You need to pick your parents better. Most of you did a pretty bad job. You know, maybe they're real good for you, but you get the different genetics. Maybe you could get a clone or something. Over here, the environment is really important. You need to control that environment. When you're young, I think is probably the best time to keep those good habits up. And drugs are absolutely no match for an uncontrolled environment. I cannot beat somebody. I put bypasses in and I do stents on that goes out and just 10, 20 pounds every month. I just can't compete against that. You're going to not make it. So try to get these people down under control. Metabolically, this is probably, again, the endothelium is your health. Now, let me take you inside the cell and understand what the cell is seeing and why it's having trouble. You need to make nitric oxide. If you take a look at this equation, and it's in your handout, so you can look at it carefully. All these different things that are affecting this, there's lots going on in this endothelial cell. It makes things grow. It is your life expectancy. So make the endothelial cells healthy and you'll find that the patients live a lot longer and they'll be much healthier long term. This is a slide I showed last year. I think it's worth looking at. If you look at the top angiogram, you see the coronary artery looks normal. The right looks beautiful artery. Guy comes in with chest pain. We cathed him, we didn't find anything, so we didn't stent anything. But within 8 months, he's back. But this time, he comes with another problem. Take a look now. He's got a block down here at the bottom. This block is actually from a ruptured plaque. This guy is obese. He did not follow his medicines. He didn't do his global risk reduction. He basically said, gosh, man, I'm in great shape. I have normal coronaries. He went out and just continued to gain weight. Okay? So let's see what's inside his heart. So for this, we go to research stuff. First, let's take a look at a part that looks normal to you. This looks normal. This is the actual outside wall. This is fat in his artery. This is my catheter here. This is actual atherosclerosis, but you can't see it. This is measuring the amount of fat in that artery by near-infrared spectroscopy. So it looks like, if you look just at the angiogram, which is a lumogram, it looks pretty good. It doesn't look bad. But you now can see why we're having trouble with this guy. Up here, he had the same disease. He just busted a plaque down here. So let's go up even higher and look. Look at this one. Coronary artery is here all the way around. Big artery, no problem. Little atherosclerosis. Now, that's intravascular ultrasound. So at this point in time, in most research labs, this is all you would have. But if you have a NIRS lab that has the actual ability to measure the fat in the artery, look at the amount of fat in this guy's artery. This thing is full of fat. It's reading signals that are telling you it's full of lipids. So this guy needs to be on a statin for sure, even though his artery looks pretty good. He'll get a statin because of that. But up here, diabetes portends a bad outcome. A normal artery is pretty much solid red all the way around. If this was my artery, I would hope it's solid red all the way around. That's what normal looks like.